Welcome to Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester and Drew Bentock of Irish Illustrated, Pete Sampson of The Athletic. We're about 50 hours removed from the most telling practice of the spring, 5 days away from number two in the form of the blue-gold scrimmage. And as such, we have something almost close to real football to talk about, guys, for the first time since December. We, Tim Priester, Drew Bentock, and I put our thoughts on the boards, put our thoughts on video. Instant analysis podcast form. So Pete Sampson, just very quickly, in your expert analysis of the jersey scrimmage, CJ Carr, good or bad?
Neither. He was outstanding.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was, it was probably one of the best practice performances by a quarterback that I've seen. He just had all the answers. In memoriam to John Bryce here, not that he's passed away, but, he's always talked about, like, hey, returning starter at quarterback. We saw what that's supposed to look like when not only do you have a guy coming back, but the guy you have coming back is like a future pro. So it was just incredibly impressive, really start to finish from Carr.
And nobody's surprised by that. I mean, that's the next step for CJ Carr. Right. Not surprised by that at all. A little. The cohesion of the offensive line, Tim. Yeah. You mentioned it. You mentioned it after the jersey scrimmage. That was pretty impressive. Will Black got Rodney Dunham ran by him one time, but by and large, you know, they opened up some holes. By and large, the second unit opened up some holes for Jonas Walton as well. So, yeah, CJ Carr, no surprise. That's about what we expect, and we said it before we started recording. Noah Grubbs. The kid goes for it, man. He'll make some mistakes. Luke Telich was hiding in the weeds and picked one off from him. So he'll make some mistakes. And we've seen some other interceptions on video that was put out there. But I give the kid a lot of credit. He's a very confident young man who's going for it.
You know, with Carr, too, I think it helps the offensive line a lot to have a guy who's going to be able to read defenses and have a lot of the answers and can process things so quickly. Because there were some where I think I would watch the replay, and I mentioned this in its analysis, and I think the edge rush maybe would have gotten more pressure, but Carr just gets rid of it so quickly and makes a decision that even if there are going to be some struggles, you have a guy who can make the adjustments, make sure they're seeing the right things. And I think with a young offensive line, that's not something we've seen at Notre Dame in a while, that somebody who knows the offense so well and kind of process things like that.
We're talking about both quarterbacks more. Tim, I like your point about the offensive line. I want to stop qualifying that Love and Price are better. If Love and Price were there, I'm not sure we would have been able to say, like, oh, the offensive line made some incredible holes, because just like, oh, those running backs are awesome. And so they get a little crease and they were gone. But these are, it's your 1B or 2 and your number 3 running back. And they were very, very good and effective. And they looked good. I mean, they look like good running backs too, but they were making holes for guys that maybe they need the holes more than Love and Price. Love and Price need a crease. I think Nolan James and Neas Williams need a double size crease, perhaps, compared to those guys to do what they do. But, man, all the credit to Nolan James. Tim and Pete, you were both on it early. I just love the way he runs. Like, it's not the same. It's nothing's going to be the same. Like, I keep qualifying it anyway. But he just runs so hard. 3 yards is 5. 7 yards is 9. 1 is 3. You know, it's it would be frustrating. He should have gone to Navy and led the nation in rushing, probably.
I have a theory, because, you know, we've been waiting to see him. We've been saying it for weeks now. I want to see him in action. And now I think we have a little better understanding. And that was exactly it. I think everybody in the media that I've spoken to or we've talked to about this, it's like, man, you think he's only got 3 yards and he has 7. And here's my theory. And it goes to Den Brock and Freeman said it too about the low center of gravity. And Den Brock used the word hovering. He runs so low to the ground that, like, let's say you're Teon Gray, you're 6'5", you want to tackle him, you're reaching down for him. You know, as a defender, you want to square somebody up and put a shoulder in somebody. His center of gravity is so low that you're reaching down for him to tackle him, and that's a difficult thing to do. So they may get hands on him at 3 yards, but then he ends up with 6. He was very – you're right, all three were impressive. I didn't like – wasn't thrilled about Jonas Walton coming out of high school because I thought he did a lot of the same things that I didn't like about Jeremiah Love, that he was always kicking it outside. Look, I didn't know.
Don't bring it up.
Did you know Jeremiah Love was going to be this? But I mean, all you could go on was high school film, and he kicked everything outside. And I thought Walton, maybe not as much as Love did.
Want to bring this up about Jeremiah.
I know. Yeah, I know. Whatever.
I didn't like Jordan because he couldn't go left.
All I could go on was a high school film with that. But you know, I thought Walton ran really well. You know, it's a and Aeneas Williams, he wants to be live. He doesn't want that red jersey on. He wants to run live because even though he's in the red jersey, he kind of runs plays at, if not 100% speed, about 85 or 90% speed.
I agree with that. Aeneas Williams ended up on the ground a lot for only going in thud and not being live to tackle. He fell every time he got the ball. He still went to the ground almost.
Pete, I want to ask you this. You made it, I believe it was on tweet on X, comment about CJ Carr. It looked like he went into Chris Ash's office the night before, looked at the playbook, knew everything that was going to happen, and was able to adjust. Wonderful subscriber who contributes often, ArrowFan624, might have overreacted when he asked Pete Sampson's comment about CJ Carr stealing Chris Ash's playbook. Does that give you concern about the defense not being good going into the season?
No, because this wasn't like Texas A&M Marcel Reed. It wasn't like guys were running wide open. Carr was finding guys when they would break open at the right time. So I thought the way – like Tommy Reese said this to me once, and I was like, this is a good way to describe quarterback coaching and play. It's like, as a coach, your job is to give your quarterback all the answers. That's the playbook. It's the quarterback's job to figure out the questions, and that's what the defense is doing. And Carr is elite at understanding what the question is, and he has got all the answers. So as soon as he understands the question, like, he's going to find something. Every defense gives you something, and Carr is expert at finding it. Now, A&M, Notre Dame's defense gave you everything.
Yeah, that's true.
That's not what's happening right now. You have a elite processing quarterback with outstanding talent and some good receivers, and you just can't cover everything. Like, CJ Carr was forcing the issue to Micah Gilbert, I might feel differently, but he's not. That's part of understanding what the defense is giving you. Leonard Moore is not giving you anything, so you go at Mark Zachary. I don't have concerns about this being a replay of last year's defense or the defense not being as good as we think it's going to be.
I don't think there's any correlation to last year. I mean, Chris Ash didn't even know the players last year. He didn't know what they could and couldn't do. I'm not saying that the defense can't start slowly again, but there's no reason for that to happen again. Last year, there were reasons. There are no reasons now. And what Pete is saying is exactly true. CJ Carr is on another plane from virtually any other quarterback in the country, let alone a jersey scrimmage at Notre Dame on April 18th.
Drew, before you try, Drew, I know you have a point to make here because you mentioned it before, instant analysis. Tim, one of those reasons is you could say that Notre Dame played four of the six best receivers they faced all year against Chris Ash's defense when he was still searching for what his guys could do. I mean, take out Makai Lemon and I'll leave room for someone else. A&M and Miami's receivers were four of the six best receivers Notre Dame played last year. And that was still, it was trial time for Notre Dame's defense at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, too, I don't know that Chris Ash was calling the most exotic defenses all the time. They were playing a lot of zone, and I expect CJ Carr to cover, to dice up any zone he sees for the most part this year, too. So, I mean, some of those throws were incredible, and not taking anything away from Carr, but he's going to find those soft spots consistently and be able to drop them in. I don't think there was I was watching the offense mostly, but I didn't think there was a lot of blitzes, or Drake Bowen's not out there blitzing like he would and those type of things. So I still think there's more Chris Ash can do. I just don't think that was the game plan going into this specific practice.
It wasn't his best throw, but my favorite CJ Carr play and throw was offsides on Mukum. Yeah, Armel Mukum. He got him to jump. Mukum came running across the line like sideways. And he didn't just chuck one deep because he knows he has a free play. He dropped back, waited, the rush started coming, and he zipped you should be going to this spot because this is where the ball should go, square in to Mylon Graham for 24 yards. Graham did go there, caught it, and got down because he was going to get hit. Like, it was one of those things where it was all trust, and maybe the best part of that is Mylon Graham knew to go to that spot and get in there, because usually when there's a free play, there's somebody runs a nine route, you throw the ball up there, and maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't. This was 24 yards that not a lot of QBs would get, and maybe the best part is that the new transfer wide receiver knew to go there and go after it and save his own life thereafter because he was.
Well, a younger CJ Carr, and when we say younger, I mean just a few months ago, I guess, would, or even the start of spring practice when he was itching to throw the ball deep and Tay Johnson's waiting back there. I mean, when you're younger, you go for it maybe a little bit more there when you're CJ Carr, but now he's thinking about what's coming up in the fall, and so he needs to make decisions. It's a practice in April, but he needs to make decisions that
Right.
correlate to a kind of decision he would make in the fall. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I don't think so because of the way
No,
Pete
I think
just described the way he
it was a
played
football
on
play.
Saturday.
Yeah, it was a
Yeah,
real football play as
exactly.
opposed to just taking a shot. We do have a related thing. A Gilmore too. If you were filling out your own depth chart, who are you penciling in as QB number two at this point? So that does not include Teddy Girard. How do Grubbs and Hebert stack up against the backup QBs of the last 5 years? Those are two much different questions. We all agree that Grubbs would be the number two at this point.
Yes. Especially based on what we've seen too, it's hard to have a strong opinion on Hebert when I saw him take he more he hit through the ball a few times in individual drills. That was about it.
And the first practice was full. Grubbs was one of the highlight players of that practice, relatively speaking. When we say highlight, I like to point this out. When Pete, I think, is the forebearer of the sending out your highlights
Yeah,
on
the
Twitter,
players who stood
right
out. Yeah.
after. And
Yes.
I always feel like I like it the way Pete does it because he doesn't put any context in where those guys stood out. It could be
I like
like
to keep you guessing.
today's best: CJ Carr, Connor Rattigan,
Yeah.
Bubakar Traore. But like, I think that's where Noah Grubbs was in the first practice. You could be like, who stood out? You didn't even have to put CJ Carr. I don't think you did, right? You just put.
No, I was in Thailand, so.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah. But Noah, like Noah Grubbs stood out. And you just have to understand our context. Noah
Yeah.
Grubbs. I want Tim Priester to use his terms. What does Noah Grubbs do?
What does Noah Grubbs do?
You keep
He
telling
goes
us,
for it.
Noah
What?
Grubbs,
He
he
goes
goes for
yeah, he
it.
goes for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That he there's a there's a there's a charisma to his game. The few times when we've seen him, there's a charisma to his game. I was going to say magic, but I thought Samson would overreact to me saying the word magic.
Yeah,
Focus
he'd
on
be
this.
the one listening who would overreact
I'm going to
to
use the word, but you know what I'm saying. You
that.
can see it. There's a body language. There's a charisma to the way he plays, and the people around you feel that. Your teammates feel that. Your receivers feel that. Your offensive line will recognize it as well. I think it's, and I'm surprised. I did not expect to see that this spring from him. You could because you're looking at a less than 60% completion rate in all four of his varsity years, and you hear about, bad receivers, this and that, but all 4 years, well, the kid is further along, at least in terms of the things that we're talking about. Now, he's been intercepted a few times, and I'm sure that Gino Guidulli would say, well, he's not as far along in this area of recognition and that stuff, but there's a charisma to his game, and I think it's palpable, it's notable.
It's rare that an early enrollee quarterback can run the offense at all. So the fact that he can like move it up and down the field, I think is incredibly impressive. So yeah, a lot of credit to Noah Grubbs. But it's like the staff did not push for Teddy Girard.
Right. It's
Just worth keeping that in mind. So I think Grubbs has been a surprise, maybe even to the staff itself.
Pete froze there, but I'm sure you said the staff did not look to Teddy Girard to push for him early because they were 100% confident in Grubbs there.
Right. Yeah. It's just so that's why I think that Grubbs probably even surprised the staff to a certain extent. Yeah.
In terms of stacking up to the backup QBs, that's not fair because Pete just used the proper word, Drew, early enrollee backup QB. But last year's backup QB was Kenny Minchie, who could have started, or Steve Angeli, who saved the season at this
Right.
point. Steve Angeli and CJ Carr and Kenny Minchie the year before were all the backups to Riley Leonard. Angeli was the Blue Gold Game MVP when he was younger. I mean, you could even put Angeli, the young Angeli, the way he showed up in his spring. He was Hartman's backup. He was still ahead, but no. But Grubbs is a early enrollee that's looking very good.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think the thing that stood out too is he, I think he handled things when they went wrong well. Like he had a couple bad snaps, and he seems to have a level of poise that I think if he has to go into a game, that's the type of thing you would want to see too. That it's not just like when everything's well blocked. When the ball's in the dirt, he picked it up, and I think he threw a completion once and he threw it away real quick. The other time that went over his head, and he was had the presence of mind that I'm just gonna tap this out of the back of the end zone because it's I'd rather be a safety than a touchdown. So I think he does some of those things too that if you're the coaching staff, you probably evaluate that positively because hopefully even if you do need to put him into the game, it's because CJ Carr maybe got rattled and tweaked something that's not necessarily he's gone for the season. And in that instance, it's putting him in and him be able to handle those type of things.
It is NFL draft week. If you did not know that, you should turn on ESPN where they have a countdown of 79 hours to the first pick, which might be a bit much, I think, but NFL draft has become a heck of a thing. Before we get into that, Tim Priester did a film review, Notre Dame men's basketball. Braden Smith joins Ethan Roberts and Logan Duncombe as veterans joining the Notre Dame men's basketball team. They could all play some basketball. They could probably use some all-stars around them as opposed to just the whole group of solid players.
Yeah, it's not Braden Smith, all-time assist leader in college basketball history, by the way. He Braden, Braden of Purdue, and this is Braeden.
You know what? I bet you nobody thought they got Purdue's all-time point guard.
No, I don't think that. Yeah, that would have been quite a surprise. But you know, a good little ball player, a guy that I think that he probably when he was at Colgate, especially for 2 years. Shot more than his shot more 3-point attempts, made more 3-point attempts than his percentage would indicate that he should take that many. But you know, he was at Colgate and he went for it. Now he lost his standing a little bit at Gonzaga. He's actually started 18 games, but in their last three, the last game of their conference tournament and two NCAA tournaments, he only played a combined 20 minutes. So he was obviously disgruntled at the end of the year. He distributes the ball really well. He takes some really, really difficult shots to make. But he's aggressive, attacks the bucket, rebounds the D on the defensive end about as well as you're going to see a guy listed at 6 foot who probably isn't 6 feet tall. Good free throw shooter, excellent assist to turnover ratio. So he does a lot of good things. He's a poor man's Marcus Burton. He's not that good. He went to Gonzaga and couldn't get the playing time at crunch time that he wanted, at least at the end of the season. But in each of these instances, Braden Smith and Ethan Roberts and Logan Duncombe, you know, they're good basketball players. I see their assets. I just don't know how well it plays, you know, in the ACC. And again, we've always talked about the ACC and it's diminished over the years, but still, it's going to be difficult for these guys to play at a high level. But Braden Smith can do some things. I would say a poor man's Marcus Burton. Hopefully, he can stay, you know, healthier than Burton was able to.
The draft of, I guess the biggest question still is, can Jeremiah Love go somewhere where he can be rookie of the year, help a team? We can see him play in playoff games and such. Heard an interesting conversation today on, you know, on ESPN. They were saying, I want to remove Jeremiah Love's name and the person and the talent from this comment. But he felt, don't take a running back at number three when you're a bad team with no quarterback. It's a really good point. Regarding the Arizona Cardinals, I think that's a great point, and that's why if I were the Arizona Cardinals GM, I probably wouldn't do it either. I'm the biggest backer of Jeremiah Love there is.
I agree. If I was Jeremiah Love, I wouldn't want to go to the Cardinals.
Right.
You know, it's like you want to a running back as a we're farther into our rebuild draft move than where the Cardinals are right now. Like you could argue the Titans are not far enough along in their rebuild to take Jeremiah Love, but
Tickets there would be nice with Cam Ward and Jeremiah Love. A
yeah, man,
lot
that
of
would be it would be fun to watch. Yeah, just the love to the Cardinals discourse that I see kicked around today seems a little bit manufactured by maybe the Cardinals threatening to take Jeremiah Love and somebody else saying like, no, we need to trade up to do it. But we'll see on Thursday night, right? I don't have the countdown timer in front of me, O'Malley.
Yeah, and I've heard.
close to what I said previously, the 79-hour range. It's around there somewhere.
I've heard Daniel Jeremiah make that same point about you a good team should draft the running backs. I'm not sure if that's who said it.
It's not him. That's not, I can't remember who it was. So.
But yeah, he shares the same opinion. I think, yeah, for Jeremiah Love's career, I mean, I know a lot of people don't like the Chiefs and they've signed a running back, but him falling to number nine before the NFL combine, I think was his probably ideal situation. Maybe not for his bank account this year, but it would have been really good for what he could have done in setting him up and all those things. So, but I agree, it's more likely he goes to a bad team and that's gonna maybe impact how productive he is right away.
Just the visual of him in a Chiefs uniform, I think would, I just think that that would, he would fit. He'd fit quite
All the
nicely in that.
touchdowns that would run
Yeah.
great, yeah. All
Yeah.
those touchdowns he would score in the Chiefs uniform. It'd be all fun and games until he plays the team you root for. But yeah, well, JB's not on this podcast, so we don't have to have any Chiefs talking here. Guys, Pete especially, you will not be on Thursday. We'll take one last ditch effort at this, Drew and Tim Priester Thursday. But I like this question. Kay Beasley is really the only way to do it, and it's a massive hypothetical because of the last name in here. As the NFL draft approaches in the land of hypotheticals, if you were a GM and all ND players were eligible, including Love, would you draft Carr, Love, Moore, KVA, Price, and what about Will Black? In what order and why? A little too
Did he?
early for me to
I
put
don't
Will.
see Price's name in there.
I threw it in there because it's
Oh,
smart.
okay. Well, you must have
Man.
thrown it in. Okay, I got to reslot him.
It's like a, am I the GM of what team, you know? Because it's, if I'm the GM of the Cardinals, I would take Carr. If I was the GM of the Commanders, I would probably take Love or Moore. But yeah, I don't know. I think that Carr will, it's like kind of hard to say Carr's going to be the highest drafted prospect of this group just because.
Love is so good.
We're having a connection problem there with Pete Sampson.
Drew, what are you, what's your take, Drew? We'll get Pete back. Pete, you broke up. I was going to get Drew's perspective. What's your list? If you had a list there, I threw in Price for you guys. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I still think Love is number one. I mean, it's hard for, I think Carr might still go higher. I don't think we've necessarily seen the top 10 quarterback last year. So you're still, I mean, we saw some really good things in the practice, but I don't know if I'm ready to say he's like that caliber guy. So I still think Love can and should be a top five pick. I think Moore would be next for me. I think he is a top 10 guy. I think even, I mean, he was a unanimous All-American. He has all the, he's faster than probably, I think, according to you, O'Malley, too. So I think those things are in his favor. Then I'd probably go with Carr. I still think he's a guy, especially if he, I mean, if you're drafting him, you'd probably want to draft him late because I think you still need to see a little bit development. So you wouldn't want him to play right away. Then I'd probably go with KVA. I still think he has the potential as a running back to be a first rounder. Then Price, then I mean, it's so early with Black, so I'd have him last. But I think I mentioned this offline, but I think Price, him going in the first round at a running back, you really need to be sure this guy's special. And I think we've seen a lot of good things from him, but I'm not sure even if he comes out and is good right away, I don't know if you still would want him in the first round because you just have to be a different level of player to be a first round
And
running back, I think.
I mean, you have to look at his ball protection, right? In the red zone, that has to be a
Right.
bit of a concern. If I'm a GM, so that's what the question is. And Pete, you make a good point, depending upon what team. But I mean, just like all things being equal, just team organization A, I'd say. And this is going to seem crazy when you hear where I slot Love, but. You know, Carr one, Moore two, Love three. Now I think they're all top 10 picks, or whatever, top 15. But that's probably the order as a GM, and then I'd go KVA four, and yeah, then probably Price five, and it's too early to tell on Will Black. But you know, I mean, as dynamic as Love is, how do you not choose CJ Carr and Leonard Moore, who at two really critical positions.
I go Love one, Moore two, because I don't think they can bust. I don't think they can bust Love and Moore without an injury. Everybody can bust with an injury. So I would go Love one, Moore two, Carr three, because you're looking for upside also. Every quarterback can bust. Almost every quarterback is a bust-worthy candidate if you go the wrong spot. I don't know if KVA can bust unless he gets another injury. He's going to be a good player. Inside linebackers don't get drafted that early, but he's an inside linebacker that, as we always point out, pretty sure can rush the passer. So he's a unique. I think he could be a great player. I would definitely get KVA healthy over Price, kind of to Drew's point, where I think it's the coolest story. Well, it'll be the coolest story for Notre Dame in a long, long, long time if Love and Price go 1-2, because it's never happened before. It's really interesting. It really never could have happened until 1998, not sharing the backfield that way, in college football. Bush and Lendell White were 1-3, right? And Cadillac and Ronnie Brown were 1-3. Somebody in between.
Was it Arkansas?
Oh,
Was it McFadden? And
yeah,
they were both
McFadden.
first rounders. I don't know if they're the first two running
Yes.
backs.
It was McFadden, probably was, but Felix Jones was a first rounder. It would be great if Love and Price could be the first. But I definitely have Price. I think KVA healthy is just, he's not busting either. KVA's not a bust player either. And Will Black's just too early. I like Will Black, but.
I don't. I mean, I hear what you're saying about Carr.
I can't find a QB
I
outside of
don't.
Peyton Manning that can't bust coming into the NFL. Carson Palmer, and he's, I
Well,
can't.
that's fair. If you
That's
put it in
really
those terms, that's fair. But just judging CJ Carr based upon CJ Carr and his commitment and his,
hard. I don't think
you
he
know,
will.
maybe the inability, that maybe the, not the quite the mobility that obviously some quarterbacks have, strength. I've talked about that in the past, but as far as throwing a football and deciphering what's going on downfield, I don't see him failing in that
Maybe
regard.
I. Those guys are big though too. He's not that big either. I mean,
No.
Peyton, I'm describing him to Peyton Manning and Carson Palmer right now, not just a guy. Like, those guys are
Yeah, CJ
30,
Carr's 6'2",
30 inches.
right? I mean,
Yes.
he's not more than that height wise.
Maybe I interpreted the question differently, but I think I'd be curious if we'd had the same question after the season and we saw what he does as a senior, how we would do it then, and what his bust potential would be then.
That's true. Bust potential could go way down if he plays 15 to 16 more games for CJ Carr. We can see a lot of things that we're like, well, now you're just sounding stupid because he's like, what, 2 inches shorter than somebody else? It won't matter that much. We'll be back with segment two, burning up the boards. Welcome back to segment two, burning up the boards. Our first question from Irish Gambler. I like this one, guys. Whose individual skill among the twos and threes stood out most to you? And do you think it will eventually translate to game day? And he's giving you a wide variety. It can be speed, run blocking, shedding blocks, route running, balance, anything along the lines where you look at that and think, huh, that might end up really helping Notre Dame on game day.
Jump in there, Drew.
I mean, I think the two players I wrote down. I think Walton, I think his speed, and as Priester noted it a bunch of times, he was running between the tackles, particularly. I think that's something that maybe the other two running backs we do think will be 1A and 1B don't necessarily have. So I think he stood out as somebody who, as he keeps developing, could contribute. And the next one's kind of cheating, but Luke Talich, his versatility, the different things he can do. I mean, I texted somebody after, like, it's not really fair that he's with the twos at times on Saturday, because he just made a lot of plays, and he's a guy who would start a lot of other places.
Talich was the first name that I wrote down. Yeah, I agree. It's like he's a varsity player who, like, is practicing with the JV sometimes when he's running with the twos. Because I mean, he looks like an adult,
Yes.
the way he's put together. Beyond that, I don't know if, like, I mean, Jonas Walton, like Drew said, is a good one. I think he'll probably get some work this year. I kind of wanted to see more from, like, James Flanagan. Didn't really. Anyway, I guess it was, well, Roddy Dunham, he's going to do something. I don't know where and how much and when, but he's going to give Notre Dame something impactful this season.
Is the question, it says, does it eventually translate to game day? Are we talking about this year specifically?
Whenever, but the sooner the better, because every
Yeah.
freshman works
Well, I
out on
mean,
eventually.
I took it as this year.
Yeah.
okay. I mean, I just kind of took it in general. Devin Fitzgerald has a chance to be really good. And again, we go talk about high school film. His junior film, I thought, wow, okay, great. He's Larry Fitzgerald's kid. But he had a great senior year and he's really taken it up a notch. Really like what I see there. Really like what I saw, again, from Noah Grubbs. Iwatade has flashed a couple times when we've
Wow.
had an opportunity to see them.
Iwatade is my pick.
Yeah.
That tackle for loss on Walton, I think. But
Yeah.
Ted Bizak had a rush. Iwatade swallowed.
Joe, and we, I know you're going to agree with this, Tim, because we commented at the same time. Joey O'Brien came up and made a couple plays. He made the open field tackle on Walton when Walton had the 32-yarder or whatever it was. Augustine to some degree. I like the aggression of Kia and Rezac at linebacker, but I don't know whether they necessarily rise
We
to
can
the
put them in
top
this. We
next
can put them
year.
in
Yeah,
this.
it would be next year. I liked what Mookum did early on. I thought he looked big and strong and quick off the snap, and they really could, he's been around for a long time. They really could use him to step forward and give him another body at defensive tackle, so you could have a really solid five-man interior defensive line group.
Mine are simple. Devin Fitzgerald is going to be a good wide receiver. He is on this list for route running and hands, and Iwatade has that long frame of Traore. When Traore came in and you looked at him and you said, that guy's going to be a player, just not this year. That was what I see in Iwatade. And I wouldn't say not this year that he can't contribute the way they rotate ends these days. Couldn't Iwatade pass Logan Thomas at some point?
Well, Logan Thomas, I see he's listed at like 215 now, but he just does not look powerful out there. I don't know how he continues to progress at that size.
To your point, Gio, I thought Iwatade was Traore at the first practice when I saw them. I didn't see the number yet, but then I saw Traore like a few feet away. I was like, wait, who is that? And then so he does look like that.
That's a good thing when you think those two guys are Boubacar Traore at the same time. Next question's a little bit related from Utah Domer. Who will have, it's not John Bryce, who will have the more impactful 26 season? Choose one from the following pairs. All right, I have four pairs for you guys. Or no, five pairs. Well, this one's easy. Walton or Osborne? Somebody wanna?
Walton.
All we have to go on at this point.
Osborne has a very bad wrist injury in which he took a bone out of his leg to repair it. I think people need to understand. Somebody put on the board that Madden Frymo has a dinged wrist. He was on crutches for his dinged wrist, the second hardest bone to heal in the human body. So I think it puts Osborne a little bit behind the eight ball here. So we all say Walton. Great one. Gilbert or Greathouse?
Oh,
And you don't compare those guys often, you
As
know?
long as Gilbert's not going against Leonard Moore 12 times a year.
They're both screwed.
Again, until Greathouse looked further, like physically looked further behind than he did day one when we saw him. So I don't know if,
I just didn't notice Greathouse run it
yeah,
for
I
me.
don't like, I don't know if he had another setback or what, but he definitely was not, close to be up and running on Saturday.
Yeah, maybe this can be a little bit of a reverse jinx, but I'm just not going to count on Greathouse being regularly available until we start seeing it. So I'm going to go with Gilbert.
I think that's a fine way to answer that. We'll do the, I'll, I will second the reverse jinx.
I'll just go on a limb and say Greathouse because Gilbert will have some competition with Porter when he comes back.
I mean, Gilbert's had a bunch of injuries too. I mean, I realize
Right.
they're not
Yeah.
nagging hamstring type injuries, but it's happened.
All right. He has Flanagan with an A or Premer, but I'm going to change this to Flanagan with an I or Premer because we would all say Cooper Flanagan with an A is going to have a much bigger impact than Ian Premer. So Flanagan with an I or Premer.
Two completely different roles if they impact.
I don't know. James Flanagan was somebody I wanted to just see more from on Saturday, and I just didn't have opportunities, so I don't know what to make of it.
I'm going to still go with James Flanagan. I think there's a lot more confidence with this receiver group for me, which I think maybe in past years, getting a guy like Aaron Premer out there when they didn't have enough pass catchers would have made maybe a little more sense. I don't know if they're going to force him. Plus, last time I saw him, he was in a boot. I know he missed like the end of his basketball season. I don't know exactly what the details with his injury is, but I'm not, until I see him, I'm not going to expect him to be out there. Whereas I do have a lot of confidence in James Flanagan, and he still did some stuff with the one. So I think at the very least that he's going to be a goal line player and play more than he did last year.
Healy or Dunham?
Before we answer, I want to ask Pete what he saw of Keon Keeley Saturday.
I just didn't really see much to comment on.
Tim and I, he made a play behind the line of scrimmage later in the scrimmage. And I made a point of keeping an eye on him, and I just felt like, the couple times that I was zeroed in on him, that he got stymied, and then I wanted to see more fight, more battle from him at that point. And as Drew pointed out when we were off the air, who does that? Rodney Dunham. Rodney Dunham doesn't give up on a play. I mean, and I'm not saying that Keeley gave up on play. I expected to see a little bit more fight from him when, he got stymied a little bit by an offensive lineman, by an offensive tackle.
Yeah, I'm gonna go Dunham too. I thought Marcus Freeman's comments on somebody asked about him after the practice, and he really tempered them, even though we saw him flash a bunch again for the second time this spring. And I almost feel like that's sometimes you want them to say positive things, but I think he's trying to like temper expectations, even though I think he is doing a lot of good things. I just don't. He's gonna make enough negative plays that I think you gotta have him out there, and it's gonna be too hard to keep him off the field. And Keeley maybe doesn't have that effort either.
I'm going to go with Dunham. However, I want to caution everyone. We had never seen a single play made by Javonte Jean-Baptiste at this point in his
Very
transfer
true. Very
journey.
true.
Like,
Yeah.
literally nothing.
And again, and all I'm talking about, look, there's so much to watch in the setting that we are in on Saturday. And if I said I zeroed in on Keeley more than three times, I wouldn't be telling the truth because there's just too many people to look at. And
He
maybe
could
I
have
picked
helped
the
us
wrong
down six
ones.
times. We don't know it, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
And like maybe he's a jumbo end now. And they're not asking him to do what Rodney Dunham's doing. I'm not going to the Jersey scrimmage seeing which defensive end holds the point of attack.
Right. We just haven't
Because
watched a
that's
lot.
just that doesn't go into a practice report.
Very quickly, guys, the instant replay, very much appreciated, by the way, of the plays. And I think it's for the coaches, not for us as much, actually. But on the big screen. But I found it, I needed a little more, a quicker replay next time I'm at the Jersey scrimmage once a year. I kept trying to see, it's the new
I know.
play leaks into the old play, and you have to decide what to watch too often.
Right.
So I need to get with the technical.
Yeah. What do you watch the live play now or the previous? Yeah, I ran into same issue.
Final one, Gray or McKinney? This guy asked a goose. Utah Domer could have been embarrassed. This guy asked a good question today. Gray or McKinney?
I think they both start.
You too. That's really good.
I think they both start too, but speculating about a guy that we, loved it. Loved a lot of what I saw of his film at Colorado. He's played 40 games, and I've said it multiple times that Deion Sanders said he was going to be a first-round draft pick going into last season. So I'm going to pick Gray because I haven't seen McKinney in a Notre Dame football uniform, but I expect him to get the other cornerback job, which is why Gray is playing nickel, largely because.
Yeah, I agree with Gray. I mean, we saw enough good things out of him from nickel too. I think he's the only first team defender who got their hand on a pass on Saturday too. So I think you're seeing some good things out of him, and I'll go with him.
I feel contractually obligated to back up Christian Gray to offset the casual fan who hates Christian Gray for getting beat by Mekhi Lemon and people like that in the uniform and Jeremiah Smith. I'm going Christian Gray because nickel's the most important position out there at times, although I would like to move nickels for the Miami game, as I have stated. I
Our
can't.
next,
Sorry, Drew, go ahead.
oh, our next question is from K Garrity 8. Do you envision the rotational approach to the defensive line will remain as active as it currently is once the season arrives?
Tim, go ahead.
Not as active as they were in the Jersey scrimmage because, that was no Jason Onyeka, so they had a heavy dose of Mullins, Gray, Brew, Mukum, and Hughes, which, you know what? Actually, I guess if Onyeka played, maybe Mullins wouldn't have played as much. I think it's a heavy rotated position, but I don't think they go six. So I would say they rotate to the five, trying to find who they could get in there as a five. And as Tim pointed out right now, it would be Mukum.
I think they'll rotate four, and
That'd be a four.
I mean, this is another thing to keep in mind. We'll probably do this podcast in early October and be like, man, they're playing a lot of defensive linemen this year because they've won their games by 40 points.
That's true.
So this is like, let me know what the rotation is against BYU and Miami because that's what the rotation is.
Yeah, that's a good point. I liked Teyon Gray the other day. I think he's really difficult to root off the line of scrimmage, and he has some mobility left and right. Marcus Freeman talked about him beating a double team. I think he catches your attention, partly because he's 330, but I also think that he, you know, I thought as I kept an eye on him because I wanted to see what his conditioning was. And again, they weren't taking nearly as many snaps as even in a rotation in a game, they didn't take as many snaps as they would. But, you know, I thought his conditioning held up. I really liked him. Would like to see Brew be a little bit more impactful than what we saw on Saturday. Maybe I missed some stuff. I like the way Mookum got off the football. I agree with you, Pete. To think that they're going to consistently go five deep, I'm not sure about that. I don't know that Elijah Hughes flashed necessarily on Saturday, but we know that the second half of the season last year, he came on pretty strong. So there's a good, and then Onyeka, of course, wasn't in there yet. So I wrote a piece today. I mean, I asked Marcus Freeman about, you know, size, and he said massive. And I mean, you know, there are still teams that are bigger than Notre Dame on the interior D line, but they've got like six guys that are 295 and above, six guys that could play, including like a Chris Burgess, who I don't think is ready. I think his time's 2027, but they're bigger and stronger, and they're more impactful. And I think there's a perception that Notre Dame, like there were times in 2024 where they didn't stop the run very well. They stopped the run. I mean, they were good last year. They were a top 10 rush defense, both in terms of yards allowed per game and yards per attempt. They were one of only 10 or 11 teams that held teams to less than 3 yards per carry. They were good last year, and they could be better this year.
I would say that Pete's point of your rotation is who you're playing good teams. Like when Notre Dame wanted the A&M game and the NIU game, they were looking to have a heavier rotation against NIU, and then guess what? They could not have a heavier rotation because that game was coming down on the wire. Miami and A&M, you tighten up your rotation.
Well,
It's
they'll
just
use four, right? I mean, they'll use four.
Because they don't have Howard Cross and Riley Mills is why I think they'll use four though. I want to pick one quick point on Teyon Gray. I liked him too. He stood out. He'll be much better off if he plays 35 snaps and not 50 snaps. So they better rotate.
Agreed. Agreed. We have a question from Otsterpol, and that question is, recently, Aaron Henry mentioned Notre Dame blitzing from the nickel position when giving an overview of what is required of that role. When I think back to last year, I feel like they blitzed from the nickel much less than I remember when the nickel was Thomas Harper and Jordan Clark. Would be curious to know how the number of nickel blitzes actually compare to 23, 24, and 25. What do you have on that, Tim?
Pete, I didn't know if you had the nickel blitzes, but I did a
I do
story.
not.
I did a story on, I don't know what day it was, last week. I did a story last week on the nickel. And he might have read the nickel story because in 23, is that Thomas Howard? Yeah, 23,
Yes.
Thomas Howard had eight pressures on the quarterback. In 24, Jordan Clark had eight pressures on the quarterback. And in 25, Devonta Smith, who you would have envisioned having the most pressures on the quarterback, had one pressure on the quarterback. Dallas Golden had none. Nope, I'm sorry, he had two. So Carson Hobbs naturally had none. He didn't play. He probably, I don't know if he ever blitzed the quarterback, and he was out after game two. So I just think it's because Devonta Smith was hurt. I don't think it was Chris Ash. Pete, would you think Devonta Smith's absence was the main thing for getting less nickel pressure, maybe? Or do you think?
That would be the guy I'd want to bring. So yeah, I would agree with that. I don't, could Christian Gray do it? Probably. Just haven't really seen it. So I don't know. I wouldn't, I guess that's something in April I wouldn't read too much into.
Yeah, we could. I mean,
Christian, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, Christian Gray has enough on his plate, you know, learning how to play press coverage at the line of scrimmage and nickel, let alone blitzing. So I guess I'll believe that when I see it.
I think
Sorry, Pete.
that this is one of the reasons you also have Luke Talich playing a little bit of nickel too, because he is a guy you do want blitzing, and we saw that a little bit on Saturday. He made a really nice play coming from the slot, I believe, to trip up. I think it was Walton, but he's a guy with the size and ability, and I think is definitely more suited for that for Christian Gray. Which, he's not also the guy who, as we've talked about before, has held up the best in turn. He stayed on the field a lot, but he does get nicked up, and you don't want that to happen if he's playing a heavy dose of nickel.
I think that's a great point. Luke Talich can be an imposing guy coming off the edge, even if it's dime, whatever you're doing, and that's when you decide to call up that pressure. I'm not sure you'd take him. I'm not sure you'd take Christian Gray off the field for Luke Talich, it could end up being a, you could do it right away to start the season when nobody has any idea what the hell's going on, but it could be a tell eventually if you take Christian Gray off the field and Luke Talich is standing there instead on 3rd and 13. But that's a great point that Talich could be the one. Irish fan 30. Priester said in his practice report that one gets the feeling the rivalry between Cooper Flanagan and Jalen Snead goes beyond just exuberant spring practice competition. That's twice now that the media has been in attendance and twice that they've gone after each other. Snead was particularly agitated and needed to be held back by teammates when Flanagan, helmet off, willingly came at Snead without hesitation. They were held apart before cooler heads prevailed. That was Priester's prose. The question is, at what point do the coaches see this and ask themselves if there is more to it than just competition between these two? Could it impact a locker room negatively?
Yeah, that was a kind of a tale of a tape type observation because Snead was really pissed, and Flanagan was coming at him, helmet off, and didn't care whether he had a helmet on or pads on. He was coming after him. It just struck me as, wow, that's a, you know, that's twice we've been to a full practice, and in both instances, you know, they went after each other, and I don't know. I don't think it's too crazy of a speculation to think that, wow, is there something else going on there?
Or just something might else be going on there now. I don't
Or
know.
is
That's,
that?
yeah, it's, I don't know. That's tough. It's, it, you definitely, it feels a little bit more than just like, scuffles, as Marcus Freeman liked to describe it as, but we don't really know what goes on in all the other practices. Just that we've heard that Cooper Flanagan is somebody who likes to mix it up with everybody, or maybe not everybody, but he likes to mix it up. So I don't know. It's kind of hard to get a read on that one.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm too worried about it carrying over into the locker room or anything like that. And then if it does, I would have to think the coaching staff and that would address that and get ahead of those things. But these are still two senior and graduate players. Like I know maybe Snead hasn't always been perfect on everything, but I think this is the type of thing that if you're having a little bit of issues, this is the type of thing you're okay with and you can deal with.
Yeah, I think Marcus is okay with these things. You can Notre Dame has survived and thrived when their quarterback and wide receiver had an issue that carried over to the locker room, their safety and quarterback. Jalen Snead and Cooper Flanagan, as long as they don't hurt each other in a fight, can have as many issues as they want for Marcus Freeman. I'll tell you guys this one time, though. I'm going to side with Priester on. I don't think that this is just a small little thing. You guys, if I gave you the over-under on scuffles in the last practice number 2 to number 12, this, let's say that was 13. You think there was 2.5 between Snead and Flanagan now that we've seen two? Over or under? I'm going over. I'm thinking something happened in the last 3 weeks, too.
Like days where they squared off,
Yeah,
because
two of them have happened. So do you go over or under 2.5?
yeah, I mean that'd be over because
What
I know we know Flanagan and Shuler get into it too, so
would you do on 5.5? Because I feel like I still might go over.
how many practices have there been?
Yeah.
I think Saturday's was 12, I believe.
All right, 11.5.
11.5. Listen, man, you put the over-under on Faison and those guys. Faison's ready to go. That dude doesn't care. You can tell. Faison's ready too. He's always saying something. And Shuler breaks up fights.
Well, and Faison's can be worse because he did it after he made a big play on somebody. So that's even worse because you're more likely to agitate them afterwards too. And he did it. That was delayed. Like, yeah, I agree.
Actually, you made a pretty good point. Snead had reason to be agitated. He was on his back when that fight started.
Our next question is from Perm. From your practice viewings and intel, who do you view as the 6th and 7th offensive line players?
Go ahead, Tim.
Based upon the way the starters are now with Oetting at center, I mean, Ashton Craig is there. Augustine definitely is there. I would say, all things being equal, Augustine's a backup. He may be, you know, with Jagasaw injured. I mean, Augustine may be a top backup at everywhere but center.
I have a question for you guys. If Joe Oetting starts well, let's pretend Craig is ready for game three. Just nice round. He makes it back before 12 months. If Joe Oetting just has two really good games as a cohesive unit, could Ashton Craig play guard?
I mean, maybe. So what?
Absher.
He unseats Absher.
Well, he doesn't unseat Knapp, so it would be
No, of course it
Absher.
wouldn't be. Yeah, it wouldn't be Knapp. It's a good question, but I think it's hard to answer right now because, Jagasaw obviously is one of their best five, and if he were completely healthy, he'd probably be the best one. I don't know. Otting's done a heck of a job. I look the and we talked about this at the time. The Notre Dame coaching staff was concerned about how he was going to do against USC, and he did a hell of a job. So I think that he has surprised, or he has overachieved, or whatever you want to call it. He's stepped up his game when he's had to. So I don't really know how to answer this right now because Craig's not in the lineup, and Jagasaw obviously isn't either. But those are the guys that are in the running. Heron would probably check in at number nine in that listing.
You have anybody different, Pete?
No, I think that Maddie Augustine really is the only reserve who's healthy, who the staff would be like, we could put him in a game probably. I think there's a pretty big drop off after Augustine.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're having him rotate at multiple positions. It's not a sign of we don't know where to put him. It's we want him to be prepared to be our backup at multiple places.
I only would throw Tarek out there because he's always been a two deep guy since his freshman year, but he's also battled injuries, multiple injuries, and he had multiple surgeries actually. So
But he was in action on
he was
Saturday.
in action.
He
That's
had a foot laceration, which prevented him from starting. Don't know how that happened, but interesting. I've got a foot laceration.
it wasn't the same way though.
No. All right, we got a question number. Ooh. Question number seven from ND Yinzer. What is the DB starting five in nickel versus Wisconsin? And what is the DB starting five in nickel versus Miami? Game one and game seven or eight? Eight?
Would you guys agree that the nickel starting five for Wisconsin is McKinney, Moore, Gray, and the two safeties?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't think it's different in November, other than for Miami, as I have said many times. I'm moving someone to nickel to guard Malachi Toney, and it's Leonard Moore. Unless Malachi Toney becomes more of a complete wide receiver and doesn't play slot all the time, and then he probably will. Why would he not? He was one of the 10 best players in the country when the season ended. He could certainly go play W and X, right? It's not
Wouldn't
like
that be a kick in the nuts if Miami saved that for Notre Dame?
he's just all over. Leonard Moore goes to nickel. Malachi Toney runs across the field in motion, just standing there the whole time.
They could. I mean, Leonard Moore was following Mekhi Lemon all over the field last year too. So it might just be that's who he sticks on, and they're adjusting accordingly.
I mean, Tony's great. I wrote this down for a future musing. At the end of the year, when they were playing the national championship game, Malachi Toney was one of the 10 best players in college football last year, as a year. He was football players. He was tremendous.
And he was a high
He
school
was.
quarterback.
And he was a high school quarterback, yeah.
Who reclassified.
Right.
I was going to say, so was Tay Johnson, a quarterback, but he didn't reclassify. But I can remember, as I was working on for the first rate stuff during the summer, and I kept checking on Miami, and I kept hearing feedback about this Malachi Toney. Boy, they really like him.
Yeah.
Now we know why. Now the whole world knows why.
So I mean I really think
Yeah,
that's the logic. I like Jaden Sanders, by the way. We haven't talked about him the whole time. I thought he was aggressive as a number two nickel in that scrimmage.
I like Sanders too. I mean, remember when we, I mean, I remember thinking that, Stroman was, they wouldn't be bringing Stroman in if he wasn't going to start, and then he couldn't. He was beaten out for the position. So McKinney, I wouldn't think that they would be, I wouldn't think they'd be moving Christian Gray to nickel if it wasn't for McKinney. And Tim, you talk about moving, and I get it, moving more to guard Tony when you play Miami, but how much run has Christian Gray gotten at corner at that point to just flip him back over there?
I think 2 years of starting at corner could get
Yeah. If
pretty
you're
well.
not taking reps there every day.
Yeah.
He hasn't played as much in the boundary. Maybe that would make it more difficult too.
I just make sure Leonard Moore's guarding Malachi Toney when
Yeah.
it's 13 and he's crossing routes on you. I
But
just.
I, yeah, but like what? We all think that that's the five, those are the five when the season starts, and by design, that would be the way it would be outside of the adjustment that you're talking about, Tim.
Our next question, Backer Tiki. As things have settled following this cycle's flirtation with the NFL, do you sense anything has changed with Marcus Freeman in regards to his desire to be an NFL coach as soon as next season? Kind of two questions in there.
Pete?
I don't know. I do know he is doing a much better job of answering questions about it than he did about 3 or 4 months ago. So that I would take that as a positive. It was funny that Esquire story when he referenced like the Steelers and the Ravens opening and be like, ah, what if those jobs open? And then they opened.
That's what I said when those jobs opened.
So, I mean, in theory, that means those jobs won't open next year or the year after that or the year after that. I just think like if he leaves, when he leaves, it will be for like the Cowboys or the Packers. It won't be for the Jacksonville Jaguars. So I don't think he's running out the door. I think the right fit would have to come along and he'd have to feel that he is ready for it. The right fits came along last year, but I'm not sure he was ready for it. I don't know. I'm not sure a whole lot's changed. I think that he's a really good coach who's getting better, and at some point, if he wants to make that jump, probably that will be available to him.
Yeah, I think Notre Dame was lucky with the timing of those that he finally announced he was coming back when I think both of those jobs opened. So I think that
The
was,
Steelers opened that day. He announced he was coming back.
So I think that's fortuitous. And I think the good thing too is if those jobs should, even if they did open up after next year, that would probably change his perception of those jobs because you've seen stability at those jobs is probably what he's after. He doesn't want to take a Giants job where the GM is on the chopping block after this year and things might be upheaval. He did, probably does want those consistencies. So I agree with you, Pete. His ability to handle that interest is probably going to get better, and he probably presumably may not let it drag out as long next time, or at least have some better way of dealing with the media. But I agree. I still think if the right fit comes along, and he gets the offer, because a lot of coaches want those jobs too.
They
But if
do.
he gets one of those jobs offered to him, I think he would still probably be very interested.
Not just stability with the Steelers and the Ravens, absurd stability
That's
for
for
the
sure.
NFL. I wrote about it in last week's Thursday Thoughts. I agree with Pete. I mean, tactically, he's not going to take a job because Freeman was talking about, the NFL, you're kind of set up to finish 500. They don't want the same teams winning every year. They want to, and because you have a draft and not recruiting per se, you're always going to get that balance. But so I think he'll be very tactical about what he chooses. I also think that if he wins a national title,
Oh yeah. Then
that's the free pass to,
every open job opens up to you.
right.
That's the thing. I mean, I think it's great that the Steelers, Ravens, Giants, and Dolphins, for obvious reasons, Dolphins, got new coaches in the offseason. The Cowboys thing, I mean, that's unavoidable. If you're looking to choose hard like Marcus Freeman wants to, and you go bring the Dallas Cowboys back to a Super Bowl after 30 years. There you go. He just chose very, very hard. That's the choice. That's the hardest choice you could make. Dallas Cowboys is hard to turn down. But like, thankfully, the Seahawks, Chiefs, 49ers, or Bears. It's good that the Bears are winning again. That helps a little bit, probably. A lot of good teams just aren't going to be looking for the head coach, and a lot of good jobs aren't. But yeah, the Cowboys one will always be. People should root for the Cowboys if you're a Notre Dame fan to make the playoffs this year. I think it's a pretty big deal. I mean, you can turn down the Cowboys job if you're a football coach.
That'd be a tough one.
I don't like the Dallas Cowboys. I'm a 49er fan, but that you tell me the Cowboys job is open, I'm changing jobs if they're offering it to me, because that is a big deal. Final question from FL Iris 76. He says, time flies. Just 10 years ago, Notre Dame had one of their worst seasons ever, and it felt like they were at rock bottom. Did you realistically think after 2016 that a decade later this program would reach this level of success in the field, acquiring elite talent again, drastically shifting the perception of the national media, and possibly being on the cusp of a championship season?
No, because we didn't, because Brian Kelly set the bar so low in recruiting that you didn't expect them to take a significant step up. You didn't, you know, Marcus Freeman wasn't a name in our heads as somebody that would come in and be able to do what he's done. But, you know, and bringing in undergrads in football, that wasn't something that was on our radar at the time. You just didn't envision a guy coming in. And look, if Marcus Freeman runs the table during the regular season, think about that. That's 36-4 in the last 40 games. No, didn't picture that. Did not anticipate that.
That year, Marcus Freeman was the co-defense coordinator at Purdue, so
I was going to say.
I can't say I saw this one coming. I will say, like, rock bottom was 2007, not 2016. Like
Yes.
that 2016, you're like, all right, this is a blip. I can see this turning around. Maybe not to the level that it actually did turn around. I would say, like, Notre Dame, the university being as all in on football as they are right now, that's not something that I would have predicted at all. Whether it be 2007 or 2016 or even 2021 on November 20th, that's been really startling to watch.
Yeah,
Before, go ahead, Drew. I'm
I
sorry.
agree. I mean, I wasn't covering the team back then, but I definitely wouldn't have seen all this. I mean, I wasn't on my radar that players are going to be getting paid by now at this point at that time either. So the things
Yeah.
have shifted so
No, they were going to
dramatically.
get stipends.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Free
So
laptops.
that's a
I
hell of
think
a stipend they get now.
maybe if I would have known that, I'd be like, well, I see. Maybe that could be a way that changes the recruiting and talent acquisition dynamic for Notre Dame and stuff like that. But yeah, that wasn't even on my radar. And it's hard to, I think the national perception thing, because growing up in South Bend, when you leave, you just know a lot of people either love Notre Dame or strongly dislike them. And Marcus Freeman's finding somebody who can change that dynamic where a lot more people are giving Notre Dame a chance, I think, is for the on the field thing. I could have believed maybe before that. And that certainly seems to have changed.
Yeah, I think it's funny. The national perception thing has changed so much from how they were perceived the moment they got left out to 1 week later to 48 hours later to now. It's changed two times because the perception wasn't that good 48 hours after they got left out of Notre Dame anymore. It was really on their side right when they got left out. Everybody felt sympathy. All of a sudden, they did not. I think it's incredible that we look at Marcus Freeman if he can pull that off. Like Priester, you said that record. Surely doesn't feel like Brian Kelly went 33-5 in a 3 year span and played for in two playoffs, does it? But he did. He went 33-5 in a 2 year span and played for two playoffs. And just because the way those season ended, it just did not feel like it. It didn't feel like it. And the middle season ended in the whatever World Bowl, the Campy World Bowl, is that what it was then?
It
So
was. Mm-hmm.
it's who you beat, and they're more fun to watch now because of the guys they recruit. And national perception changes quickly. They could be the best thing Notre Dame could do is become the villain again because they're so mean, blowing people out and going 16-0 and rubbing it in people's faces. That would be the best way to change your perception again and have everybody hate Notre Dame that's not a Notre Dame fan. You don't want any sympathy, right? That's bad. Sympathy's bad, man. They're very capable of running this table, and I cannot wait for that 3 game stretch in 3 games in 5 weeks. BYU, Miami and SMU, that range. That's gonna be fun. Pete Sampson, until then. Actually, I'll talk to you before that. I'm not sure if you're in our podcasters, but we'll speak before then. I'll see you at the Blue Gold game. For Pete Sampson, The Athletic, Drew Mentok of Irish Illustrated, Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.